With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, our head analyst, Rory Caron, and our financial analyst, Anne-Marie Kingsland. Today, we're talking about Microsoft making its second largest acquisition of all time, why Facebook might be in big trouble thanks to Apple's new update, and both Rory and Anne-Marie pitch me two exciting companies that they're interested in at the minute. So guys, we have a new voice on the podcast today. Anne-Marie, welcome to Stock Club. So you joined us here at My Wall Street a few months ago, and you've been working closely with both Emmett and Rory over the past while. Say hello to the people listening to the podcast, I suppose, and what areas or industries within investing are you particularly interested in, or do you focus in on the most?
Hi guys, thanks for having me. So actually something I'm looking into right now is autonomous driving technology. It was something that came up when I started doing research on Google this week, and kind of the competition between Waymo, which is Google's autonomous driving technology, versus Tesla, and the two strategies that they're using in terms of LiDAR sensors. So that's something I'm researching at the minute, so that's kind of interesting.
Where are you from, Emery?
Colorado.
Are you from Denver?
From outside of Denver.
Okay, because I've always had a question about Denver. I saved it up for the podcast. You know the way it's called the Mile High City?
Yeah.
Does that mean anyone who's ever had intimate relations in Denver is in the Mile High Club?
I guess you could say that, but there are specific parts of Denver that are like labeled as being a mile high. So if you go to Coors Field where the baseball team is, there's like one level of seats that is purple because they're like, this is officially a mile above sea level. So I guess if you're in that row of seats at Coors Field, then yes, you can say that.
I have an additional question. This one is for Rory. Rory, how long have you been holding on to that question for?
I actually only thought about it last night because I was looking up the conspiracy theories around Denver International Airport, which is a whole other podcast.
Is that the airport that's like linked to Satanism or something? It's in like a 666 shape.
There's loads of weird stuff going on.
Okay, well, maybe that's a new branch we can extend into conspiracy theories about airports. So let's kick on. We've got a pretty packed schedule today. So the first thing I want to talk about, which is the biggest news of this week, I think, is the news that Microsoft has acquired Nuance Communications at a staggering $19.7 billion price tag. This is Microsoft's biggest purchase since LinkedIn back in 2016. Nuance is an AI company that has developed speech-to-text software and is probably most famously known for its help in the development of Apple's AI assistant Siri. Most recently, the company has been involved in the healthcare industry too, and in the press release Microsoft released to announce the deal, they mentioned that Nuance will be used to expand its Microsoft Cloud for healthcare capabilities. Emmett, I'm going to come over to you first because I know you have a bit of a history, maybe is the right word, with Nuance Communications. First off, what are your thoughts on Microsoft shelling out so much for this company?
Well, to answer that question, I would like to hop in a time machine and go back a little bit, James, because it's quite a story. And I have to start by declaring that I am a former part owner of Nuance. In other words, I was a shareholder. And I had a quick look at my brokerage. It's open here in front of me. I first bought 210 shares in Nuance in June 06 for $9.22 a pop. Then I bought 200 more that August for $7.25 a pop. And then I bought a final 90 shares the following April, which means I had 500 shares, which I sold in September 09 for $14 a pop, making me the only person in history to have made money on Nuance. And that $2,000 gain was fab. I was very happy with myself. But
yeah,
there is a dark side to this hot ticket of voice recognition. And if I go further into the annals of history and into shareholder registers, there's a certain Emmett Savage, which is me, actually, in this story, who was invested in a company called Learnout and Housebee Speech Products, or L&H, which was a Belgian-based speech recognition technology company founded by two individuals, Joe Learnout and Paul Housebee. And it floated on the NASDAQ in 1995, and at that time caught my attention, as at that time I had a feeling speech recognition would be like a dominant theme of technology in the future. So I bought shares way, way back when. Now, during March of 2000, Learned and Hesby was the hot ticket. You couldn't be an investor without at least being aware of them. And they were on this acquisition, like, kind of roadshow, and they acquired Dictaphone, you know, like,
yeah.
The original voice recognition machine. They acquired Dictaphone for $1 billion. And then shortly after, they acquired Dragon Systems. They were buying up everything to do with voice recognition, left, right, and center. And unquestionably, they were the growing monopoly in all things to do with speech recognition. But in, like, I suppose before they, let me think, it was in 1999, the Wall Street Journal ran their Heard on the Street column. And it was written by a chap who works in Goldman Sachs, or did at the time, called Robert Smithson. And he said that their earnings had been overstated. And with that article, trouble was born in speech recognitionville. So so I need to read an excerpt, hold on, from Wiki, because I don't want to lowball what happened next, but yeah. It's relevant. It gets I haven't forgotten the question.
I am suitably excited to hear this.
Yeah. So I'm reading from Wiki. Here we go. Further investigation by Wall Street Journal staffer Jesse Eisinger led to the revelation that on the 8th of August 2000, of a major financial scandal involving fictitious transactions in Korea and improper accounting methodologies elsewhere. In April 2001, founders Joe Learnhout and Paul Housby, as well as former CEO Gaston Bastines, were arrested in what is considered to be one of the largest corporate scandals in history prior to Enron. Learnhout and Housby finally went bankrupt on 25th of October 2001 after having struggled for a year. And a certain Emmett Savage, which is still me, lost his entire investment, which that bit isn't in Wiki, but I am going to add it in. And what has this to do with Nuance? Well, let me tell you, after that bankruptcy, Nuance Communications, which at that time were known as Scansoft, that was their name, acquired all of the speech technologies that Learnhout and Hesby had on their books for, like, something like the price of burrito. I remember guffawing at how ridiculously low a price it was, and they made something of it. And today, that crock of, well, you know what, has become the second largest acquisition Microsoft has ever made. They're paying something like $19.7 billion. And by the way, the Dragon naturally speaking product that they had bought, that Nuance had bought some 20 years ago, has endured and is still, as far as I know, the flagship product of Nuance.
Yeah.
And it is, I guess, one of the cornerstone investments that Microsoft has made. And I guess the moral of the story for floated businesses is just survive. Just survive. I mean, like, it is.
And the other moral is that Emmett Savage will never forget if you screw him over.
Yeah. Oh, by it was the first, and I'm reluctant to say only, actually, look at this, James. Our listeners can't hear this, but this is a class action. You get these class action calls for class action lawsuit, and this is for Helios and Matheson, who did the cinema ticket scam. But anyway, but I think the only company I ever lost my entire shirt on was Learnhout and Hesby. My whole investment went up in smoke. I think I lost $2,000, which is precisely the profit, or the capital gain I made on Nuance. Now, one last point, James, right? Because I'm obviously on a rant and I'm on a roll. But like 15 years ago, Dragon's naturally speaking software, which I bought to write with, would more accurately transcribe more words from my broken dishwasher than from me. In fact, I think I left my laptop on the dishwasher and I came back and like an ode to a Grecian urn was written out for me. Whereas in fact, if I spoke into it, I couldn't get it to string 5 words together. So when I saw the acquisition by Microsoft, I thought, I hope someone at Microsoft plugged it in and gave it a shot, because honestly, I'll never promote her. I mean, it's a $20 billion piece of kit. I guess they looked at it, but hey, we'll see.
I have a story about Nuance as well.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
How do two people have a story about a voice recognition piece of voice recognition software?
Well, I'll make it a short story. Essentially, when I was in college, I sprained my hand. I can't remember if it was surfing or sailing, and anyway, I had a thesis to write, so I ended up downloading this incredibly expensive software, which I believe was Dragon, or it was linked to Dragon anyway. And the idea was that you could talk into your computer and it would type it out for you so that you could...
Exactly.
And it took like days to get onto my old crappy laptop, and it didn't work very well with Mac either. There was some problems there. And anyway, after about 2 or 3 days of trying to get it to work, I realized it was about as useless as a chocolate teapot, and gave up, and it was just a total disaster.
So I'm guessing from this, neither of you are too bullish on this new purchase from Microsoft.
I don't know anything about it. I mean, the fact that they created Siri says a lot, because Siri's crap.
But it appears to be part of this kind of Microsoft's move into the healthcare industry too. And as part of the deal, Nuance currently has about 10,000 healthcare customers on its books, including the likes of Athena Health, John Hopkins, and the Cleveland Clinic. Do we think this might have been, on Microsoft's part, a bit of a land grab and kind of snapping up these big healthcare customers?
Yeah, and actually, you know, although I make light of it, and the Dragon Naturally Speaking software 15 years ago was complete rubbish, I'm sure it's good now, because there is a standard that the world has come to expect. And I think it's quite a smart acquisition. I think Microsoft have done a really good job at changing their entire storyboard over the last few years. And I think they continue to do so with Nuance. Like, you know, this is their second biggest after LinkedIn, isn't that right?
Yeah.
They paid more for LinkedIn. I'm obviously trivializing the purchase, but I would imagine that there's quite a lot of very well paid and intelligent MBAs sitting in Seattle in Microsoft HQ who've looked at this and said, we can make something far, far bigger of this than 20 billion would suggest today.
Funnily enough, they spun off a business about 18 months ago that I'm quite interested in, called Cerence, which was tipped off to me by Jason Moser at the Motley Fool, which is voice software for cars. So that's a company I've been keeping quite an eye on, and yeah, interesting that got spun off just before.
And Rory, just one last point on this conversation. You know, we spoke in the last episode of Stock Club about Amazon's incursion into the telehealth industry with Amazon Care. And now we're talking about another big tech giant kind of further embedding itself into the world of healthcare. Do you think healthcare is becoming the new gold rush for these big tech companies that don't really have anywhere left to expand?
Well, I mean, not knowing much about Nuance or what, you know, the crossover that Microsoft has in mind with this, I definitely think healthcare is a space that people are getting into. And yeah, we talked about it when we talked about the Stock of the Month podcast, and we might be talking about it again in the upcoming segment.
Oh,
just a little teaser for you.
Exciting. By the way, I got some feedback after last podcast that it was a great show. And I was like, wow, it's the first show I did zero preparation for.
You're not supposed to say that on air, Emmett.
Nothing. I actually, so I didn't do any for this. So come on, hit me, whatever. Hit me with a subject.
Right, let's move on then. And the next thing we're going to talk about, it seems quite boring on the surface, but it's actually a topic that will have big ripple effects on a lot of the companies in the My Wall Street shortlist. So an impending update to Apple's iOS system looks like it's going to have a huge effect on the digital advertising titans like Facebook. Apple's new iOS 14.5 update, which is slated to arrive sometime this month, will see iPhone users now being asked to opt into the device tracking by advertisers rather than opt out, as was the case up until now. So what this essentially means is that apps which use ad tracking technology for advertisers will now be required to provide users with a standard warning and an opt-in message before they're installed. Of course, it's expected that many iOS users will opt out of this kind of tracking when asked, which will in turn severely impact sales of advertisers. Rory, I'm going to come over to you first for your perspective on this. It might seem like a boring topic, as I said, but considering that the vast majority of someone like Facebook's $86 billion in annual revenue comes from advertising, surely this is going to have a massive impact on the company.
Yeah, it's not exciting news, and it's not actually really news because it was announced well over a year ago now, or maybe June last year. But what's happening now is it actually is going to be rolled out. We think it'll be rolled out in the next release at the end of this month. And yeah, it's the basic premise is a change in Apple's policy regarding the use of tracking user data in iOS, and that you have to get consent basically to share people's data with third parties. And it's a massive change in just the whole concept of advertising. You know, for years, we've just been kind of operating under this kind of belief that people were fine with their data being collected, yeah. And that their movements and behaviors being shared and sold, unless they specifically said no. And even then, it was very hard. You know, it was often buried very deep in the back of a company's privacy settings or in an app settings.
And on that point, Rory, I think people were fine with it because people didn't really understand what their data could be used for. I think it was only in the last few years people started to be like, hold on a minute.
Yeah, and I mean, there's kind of two sides of the argument. I think in some ways it's kind of played up quite a lot by the media in terms of what's actually being tracked. You know, people, look, no company is really interested in your personal life. You know, it's part of a bigger data set that, you know, of anonymized data that helps them basically figure out how to best target advertising to people. But, you know, even in, you know, when we were discussing the Stock of the Month podcast, Yumi talked about that book Nudge by Thaler and Sunstein and how that related to behavioral healthcare. Going back to that book, one of the main points the authors made was this power of the default position, you know, and they cite many studies in the book, but the one that always stands out to me is the one regarding organ donation. And there's countries, particularly in kind of Northern Europe, like Norway and Austria and Sweden, where they have an opt-out system regarding organ donorship. So basically, everyone's an organ donor until you specifically say you're not an organ donor. Meanwhile, in Ireland and the UK, you actually have to opt in to become an organ donor. And of course, most people, even though they might say they wouldn't be opposed to donating their organs, never opt into the system. So, I mean, up until now, we've very much been living in an opt-out system in terms of letting other companies harvest and sell our user data. Apple is now turning that on its head and saying, from now on, it's opt-in. You have to ask users to opt into this. And importantly, it doesn't just apply to Apple's own identification system, what's called the IFDA. This applies to any app that's in the App Store. If they're transmitting any data to third parties, they're going to get in trouble. And now that means that not only are they going to have to, you know, ask people not to do it, but they're also going to have to monitor each app when it comes in, and there's going to be an analog element to it as well. And, you know, Tim Cook, when he was asked about this, said, I'll send out a quote here. It says, technology does not need vast troves of personal data stitched together across dozens of websites and apps in order to succeed. Advertising existed and thrived for decades without it. If a business is built on misleading users, on data exploitation, on choices that are no choices at all, then it does not deserve our praise. It deserves reform. And I completely agree with him on that. And obviously two businesses that were going to be most affected were Google and Facebook. And Google actually really didn't put up much of a fight. They kind of said, you know what, we were kind of moving away from this model anyway. We get an awful lot of data through our own sites anyway, so we don't really need to worry about that. Facebook, on the other hand, launched a huge campaign to fight back on this. A PR campaign, took out full page ads and newspapers, arguing that this would fundamentally change the way the internet worked for the worst. And claimed that really what Apple was doing was going to damage small independent content creators the most. They particularly kind of pointed at, you know, people who have like recipe websites, which to me, again, was just annoying, because so many times you go to a website for a recipe and you read about, you know, 30 minutes worth of just them talking about, you know, when they went to Italy and were in Santorini. And that the only reason they do that is basically to juice the SEO system so that they can get more advertising onto their site. So I don't really agree with them on that. Anyway, since then, I'm ranting here. Since then, Facebook has come out and been a lot less hawkish on the whole idea. They've claimed that they're even going to benefit from this change. That sellers will find it easier now to sell directly on Facebook's own property. It's hard to say if that's just a face-saving exercise or something they actually believe. I think they noted that it's going to be kind of at the end of this quarter or maybe the next quarter where we're going to see the impact this is going to have on Facebook's business. But moreover, this whole move is very much started back years ago with the San Bernardino incident and Apple coming out and becoming kind of the privacy tech company, the company that said, we are going to be the ones who protect your privacy against all the others. And at the time, you know, we talked about what Ben Thompson calls a strategy credit. You know, this wasn't necessarily, you know, it seemed like a big announcement at the time, but really didn't impact Apple's business that much, as they weren't really focused on advertising. But now we look at it and we see, well, Apple is now very well positioned to be kind of the privacy tech company. And what does that open it up to? It opens it up to things like healthcare, which we were talking about with Amazon.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the real move here is.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I suppose, how Apple justifies the premium price of its products. It's that you have that extra privacy and security. And this topic, I suppose, raised an example in my mind, and it was something we've talked about before, is how so many businesses are so dependent on other companies in order to make their money. You know, we've seen this with Apple before in terms of Epic Games and Match.com criticizing the App Store fees they charge. We've seen it ourselves in our own company about, you know, how you're kind of beholden to the rules Apple sets to you in the App Store. Is this something you look at when you're considering an investment opportunity? Do you think about how much a company's sales and its overall business is influenced by the whims of other companies?
Yeah, and actually I do very much so. And like since commerce was born, there's been an interdependency between two or more businesses. There's barely a business that scales that doesn't have very, very many suppliers. And there's a lot of different ways you can go about it. I guess the first and foremost is you look at the cost of sales and what are the constituent parts and the cost of sales. But I guess, you know, where I always like to come from is more of a strategic view, because we invest in businesses with great strategies, and business strategy encompasses a lot of things at its most fundamental level. Like strategy is the arrangement of resources at your disposal to achieve a desired outcome. So you start off with a mission and a vision and all that stuff. But then when you get down to it, there's some really interesting writings on like the strategic power of a provider of a service. And Michael Porter, Professor Michael Porter, I think of Harvard University, came up with this framework called Porter's Five Forces, which anyone who's done an MBA or a master's in strategy or probably even a business degree has looked at in some at some level. And effectively, Porter says there's five forces. Technology is not one of them, but there's five forces on every business, and like the bargaining power of the buyer. But one of those five forces is the bargaining power of suppliers. And I look at a business, and there's kind of a couple of simple checks I'll usually run. Like there's the simple one, which is, can Fang, one of the Fang family, destroy this business overnight? And that is a conversation unto itself. But then it's like, how much of what they earn is ultimately flowing backwards? And can they move into the vertical? Can they actually own the entire supply chain? And businesses that grow to $1 trillion in valuation generally have owned the entire vertical, the entire supply chain.
Amazon jumps to mind straight away when you think of that.
Oh, entirely. Entirely. Look at Apple even. They went into into retail, which was, when they did it, nobody wanted to go into retail, but they wanted you to feel you're in a boutique, you're in this special place carved from wood and glass and stone, and, you know, there was somebody there to look at you, and they got rid of cash registers. But anyway, do I look at how much of the cost or the ticket goes backwards? I absolutely do.
Yeah.
And I think the big debate, and we feel it, my Wall Street, we see the cost of a sale. We see Apple or Google take a big chunk out of the monies that our customers presume is going fully to the business, but are not. About 70% comes our way.
Yeah. So let's move on then. And Maria, I want to come to you on this one, because this is something you wrote a Daily Insight about in my Wall Street last week. And, you know, a lot of recent news around Amazon has focused on the fight it's been having recently to stop unionization in its workforce. The company recently came out on top of a union vote in Alabama with more than a 2-to-1 margin, but they still get a lot of criticism about the treatment of their workers, and especially in their warehouses. I wanted to ask you, Henry, what are your thoughts on investors who are looking at a company like Amazon? You know, on one hand, it's had massive growth in terms of its share price over the past few years. But on the other hand, a lot of people might have ethical questions about a company like this, especially around its business practices.
Yeah, it was something that was kind of the angle I took on it on Thursday, was I think it's something that each investor kind of has to make the decision themselves and determine how much of an impact is a scandal like this going to have on your ability to hold a stock for years and years to come. I think I personally don't hold Amazon, and I know kind of a lot of people in my age range, I think that would be a hesitation that they have in investing in general, is sometimes they're like, I don't know. I know that Amazon is going to grow exponentially in the next 10 years, but I don't know, do I necessarily want to be associated with that, or, you know, making a profit off that, even though you're just a stockholder, you're not necessarily, you know, joining their board of directors.
Exactly. I suppose another point you made in that, which I thought was interesting too, was the fact that a lot of you know, when we talk about ethical investing, some people tend to think that as a hard and fast category, but it kind of misses the point that a lot of people have different ethical considerations and what they consider, ways they in which they consider a company to operate ethically. You know, you mentioned there about, you know, diversity on boards and leadership teams, and especially gender diversity. You mentioned things about Warren Buffett investing in tobacco companies. How important, I suppose, is it that that people invest in what they themselves find ethical rather than what, you know, they might think is ethical in a general sense of the word?
I definitely think it's something, particularly in the situation that we're in, where we're promoting you picking individual stocks. You know, you're not picking a fund and you're sitting saying, okay, I'm going to hold this stock for 10, 20, 30 years. It's definitely something like you need to do it for yourself on a stock to stock basis. You need to sit there and say, okay, am I going to be comfortable with where this company is going to go in the next 20 or 30 years? And I think that's a huge issue with, say, tobacco or oil companies that people began to make probably back in the 80s and 90s, where they were like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with how this industry behaves. And so they began to distance themselves from it, even if, you know, oil stocks have incredible dividends. You know, I think you have to kind of say, if this stock was to plummet, would I still hold it, even if I disagreed with it morally?
Yeah. What about you, Rory? So looking at the companies in the My Wall Street showroom at the minute, ethically speaking, there might be question marks over some of them. I think Facebook is probably the most pertinent example, them being frequently accused of undermining democracy as a whole. But there's other companies like Microsoft, which I know recently had an employee protest over its decision to take on a military contract. What are your thoughts on the kind of the whole idea of ethical investing?
Yeah, I feel like we've had this conversation a couple of times, but it's worth, I suppose, repeating in light of what's happening with Amazon at the moment. You know, when you talk about ESG investing, we've had the conversation before where basically every company these days is an ESG company because, you know, you hire someone to be your ESG person and they put out a lot of press releases about how ESG you are. In terms of like the ethics of investing, it's one of those things that's just so fluid, isn't it? You know, there's certain things I know just between me and Emmett in terms of our, you know, we've talked about it plenty of times in the past, companies that we probably just would never touch. I'm talking about like, yeah, tobacco companies is probably pretty high up there. We don't invest in energy companies, for example, or definitely kind of the fossil fuel companies. We don't invest in gun manufacturers. These are just kind of things that the two of us collectively have kind of decided are just not for us. Now, at the same time, you know, I said we have Facebook in there, we have Amazon in there, we have Coca-Cola in there, you know, Big Sugar. I'm sure that's done an awful lot of damage to people over the years. So, you know, we're not perfect. We haven't got all the right answers. We've drawn a line somewhere. I suppose it's just for everyone to draw their own lines. You know, that's really what it's about. If you feel comfortable holding a stock, and like every company has its, you know, positives and negatives, I suppose. Don't hold me to that. I'm sure there's some out there that have no positives. that's just part of investing. It's part of, like, you know, and as Emmett often says, you know, your portfolio should be a reflection of your beliefs in the world. So, you know, if you believe in something, if you believe it's going to be big over the next 10 years, it's going to be a positive impact on the world over the next 10 years, or you could be one of those people who has a very negative view of things, you know, a real pessimist and think the world's gone to hell. So you can invest that way as well. I believe there's actually an ETF for companies that have, like, you know, bad effects on the world. I think it's called Vice.
Really?
Yeah, it's got all the alcohol companies, all the casino companies, all the tobacco companies, all the gun companies, and I think it has that one and only strip club company, publicly listed strip club company, whose name I can't remember now, but I remember looking at a few years ago thinking that was wild. There was a chain of strip clubs listed on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, and it's wild that there's an ETF that follows companies like that. I don't think that'll be up for inclusion in my Wall Street shortlist anytime soon. Let's move on then, take a look at some of the things going on in my Wall Street at the minute. So we're midway through the month, which means that both our new Stock of the Month pick and our exclusive Stock of the Month podcast live in the My Wall Street app right now. This coming Monday, we're also adding a new stock to our market-beating shortlist, which at time of writing has returned an average of 184% versus the S&P 500's return of just over 72% in the same time. Rory, have you any clues for us for this upcoming stock?
No, don't even know what it is yet. I'm picking a bit late. There's just so much choice out there at the moment. It's hard to pinpoint.
So much value. So don't forget that it's only members of the My Wall Street community that will get access to all of this great stuff. So if you want to check it out, just tap the link in the notes for today's show and start your free trial. It looks like it's going to be as much of a surprise to you as it is to us. So let's move on to Jargon Busters. And Rory, I'm going to come to you first on this. And this is a company that we actually asked about quite a lot, which is BlackBerry. Stephen wrote into us via email, recently asked us what our thoughts on BlackBerry were, especially stock price we've seen over the past year or so.
Yeah, the BlackBerry is by far, it's one of the companies that I am asked about probably more than any other business. And my response to Stephen is, why are people so obsessed with this company? It seems like it's kind of just relentless. I suppose there's an awful lot kind of going on in terms of BlackBerry. It's often kind of mentioned alongside, I suppose, the GameStops and the AMCs of the world. It's this kind of major business that had a huge amount of brand recognition 10, 15 years ago, which is now, I mean, like, you look at the stock chart over there.
Well, I was actually looking at before we started recording, it's down 94% still from its all-time highs in 2008. And of course, we all know what was released in 2007, the iPhone.
Yeah.
It's pretty telling.
This is a problem that I think a lot of new investors definitely fall into, is this concept of anchoring. So you typically look at a stock and you see, and this is very much an extreme example off it, but you look at a stock that's maybe, you know, 30-40% below a recent all-time high, and your immediate kind of thought is, well, it's 30-40% below where it was recently, therefore I'm getting a 30-40% discount on where it will be again at some point. You know, this idea that, well, if it hit that at one point, it'll definitely hit it again at some stage. It's the old buy low, sell high nonsense that gets so many new investors into trouble. And in terms of BlackBerry, I mean, you know, I haven't really looked at this in, I'd say, about 2 years. We were getting an awful lot of kind of people asking about it. And I know they were getting into software. It was end-to-end encryption software. They had a new OS that was focused around kind of cars and the Internet of Things. And, you know, I have to kind of admit ignorance here, and that I don't really know how it's been going. I don't think it's not a particular area that we focus on because it's kind of linked to cybersecurity, which we kind of almost bowed out of a while ago. We realized that it's a far more complex industry than I'm kind of able to get my head around. But it's, you know, in terms of, if I was just looking at it from a financial point of view, its revenue has been kind of flat to going down over the last couple of years. I don't think it has the same kind of, definitely not, it's a B2B company now anyway, so it doesn't matter, but it certainly doesn't have the same kind of brand recognition that it used to, or anywhere near the same sort of prestige. And yeah, it just kind of seems to be a company that's muddling along, switching tact all the time, doesn't ever seem to kind of really execute on its long-term goals. And I stand to, you know, as I said, I stand to eat crow pie here in a couple of years when it's blasted off. But yeah, it's more, I'm more interested in BlackBerry around the interest that's generated around it rather than actually what's going on in the business itself.
And Marie, you had a great story about Barack Obama and his BlackBerry when we were preparing for this podcast.
Yeah, it was, for years he was made fun of when he was president, because they were always like, why don't you have an iPhone? Because he became president in 2008, and he would walk around with a BlackBerry all the time. And he was like, oh, the Secret Service informed me that I have to have a BlackBerry for security issues, because it's the only one that they can fully secure and ensure that won't get hacked. And then I think immediately after he left office, there was a big scandal that all of these BlackBerries had been hacked.
And Rory was just talking about the strategy credit Apple now have with, you know, being the most secure thing. So I suppose it just looks like, shows how BlackBerry was left in the dust. So, Emmett, I just want to throw the final question over to you. And this comes in from David, again, through the My Wall Street app. He was asking about our thoughts on Virgin Galactic. This is one of the stocks you've picked in the Horizon portfolio, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. I'm a huge fan of Virgin Galactic because they have a first mover advantage, back to that strategy thing, in suborbital space experience for private astronauts, which is effectively us. Now, we can all see there's a race upwards, and SpaceX dominate the storyboard, if you like, of going up into space. But there's kind of three bands in space. At its most simple, there's suborbital, where Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin are aiming their rockets. There's orbital, which is where SpaceX and Gateway and Axiom Space and, you know, are pointing their different rockets. And then there's lunar and interplanetary, which is way out beyond planet Earth. And SpaceX and Space Adventures would be the leaders in that. So if you take those three bands, if you like, there's effectively just two players in suborbital experiences, Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin. And there is effectively only one player in the recreation of going up to space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose one of the big risks, or I suppose the near-term risks you see with a company like Virgin Galactic, is that it makes no money at the moment because it's not operating as it's intended to be. Would you, I suppose, categorize Virgin Galactic as one of the wild card stocks you talked about recently on that webinar you ran?
Well, yeah, you could make it fit, but I never thought of it as that because where I took inspiration from Virgin Galactic was that story that I've probably regaled here in the podcast before about the realization that you invest in a megatrend very early and just stick with one of the leaders through thick and thin once that new industry is fully in flight. There's no pun intended. There's massive, massive returns to be made.
Yeah.
And the specific one that I've, I suppose, nurtured in my heart my whole life was Dell, which went up 1,600-fold during the decade of the 1990s. And that is like transformative wealth creation gains. Now, obviously, going up to space is not as mass market as a home or business computer. I'm fully aware of that. But right now, nobody I know personally has been up to space. Nobody I know personally has an ambition or has had a conversation about, you know what, I think I'm going to go up to space for a vacation. But it will happen in our lives. It will happen that to get from London to Sydney, which is the overused example of a long journey, rather than it taking, and I'm really shooting from the hip here, let's say
16 or 17 hours.
Right? Yeah. Okay, 16 or 17 hours of airborne travel, it could take 2 to 3 hours. And there are people who have deep enough pockets that that time is worth going outside the ionosphere. I mean, today, Virgin Galactic is a $6 billion business. It had a run post-IPO. It kind of got some hot attention, but they are approaching their corner of space travel in a different way to all the other ones. And since its foundation, like the founder's view is that there is an opportunity to provide normal folks, private individuals, a space travel experience at far less cost than anyone else, like governments or traditional spacecraft providers. So I think Virgin Galactic is one of these ones you look at, you invest in. It's in the same family, if you like, as CRISPR, which gene editing, very few people have experienced or know someone who's experienced this technology. But do I believe that space travel is going to be a certainty? Yes, I have it up in the 90 percentile of certainty and our 90 plus percent of certainty. And then do I believe that Virgin Galactic has the resources to survive the journey, because it has 660 million cash on the balance sheet at the moment. It is all about, no pun intended, runway. They need to survive. They need to get credible. They need to have zero loss of life, if possible. But ultimately, this industry will light up in our lifetime.
Absolutely. So let's finish up today's podcast and we'll move on to elevator pitch. So I'm going to give you guys a bit of a free rein today. I just want you to pitch me a company you're researching or interested in at the minute. Rory and Anne-Marie, I've asked you guys to prepare this. So Anne-Marie, I'm going to come to you first, seeing as it's your first appearance on Stock Club.
Great. Throw me right into the fire.
Right into the fire. That's it.
Yeah.
we're judging. You're not coming back if this is a bad pitch.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, and we record every 2 weeks, so it better be good in 2 weeks.
Yeah. So a company that I'm looking at is Freshpet right now. Freshpet makes fresh refrigerated dog food that you can either get through a subscription service through some various online channels, or you can pick it up in your local grocery store. The main reason I'm kind of interested in it is that there's been a 4% growth in pet ownership during 2020. We've seen everybody run out during the pandemic to get a pet because they were scared they were going to be lonely. And the largest growth of this has been dogs. Everybody wants a dog.
Yeah.
And the kind of reason that it caught my attention, specifically Freshpet over, you know, kind of a large conglomerate like Smucker's, for example, which owns Kibbles and Bits and Ainsworth, is because there's this really weird viral trend online of people like giving their dogs completely raw food, and they think this is like the wellness trend but for pets. And they give them like chicken legs and like lamb hearts and quail eggs and all this weird stuff. And I think that that's a real flash in the pan. Like, I don't think that's a sustainable fad. I don't think that that's something that people can do over a long period. But I do think it's the most extreme example of a growing trend we're seeing, where people are becoming more conscious of what they're giving their dogs, and they want to give them better food, food that they can recognize that has, you know, vegetables and meat in it. And Freshpet really corners that market, where they label themselves as being all natural. All of their meat is either 100% beef or chicken. And so I think that they could ride this wave really nicely and have some nice growth. That being said, their valuation at the minute is really steep, but it's on my radar. We'll wait and see.
It really feeds into that humanization of pets trend we've talked about a lot, Rory, and that awful, awful term
you introduced
me to, which is... no, Luke, you can just beep that out. sorry, what's the name of that company again, Anne-Marie?
That's Freshpet.
Freshpet. Rory, what stock are you looking at the moment?
Yeah, interesting one I'm keeping an eye on. It's recently IPO, but I've made no... haven't hidden the fact that I'm not a big fan of the gig economy delivery companies like DoorDash and Uber Eats. However, at the same point, you know, delivery is going to be a huge part of the restaurant industry over the coming years. So I have been keeping an eye out for a company that was able to kind of square that circle, essentially. And one that's recently IPO is a company called Olo. So Olo essentially allows restaurant brands, restaurant chains, even kind of independent restaurants to build their kind of own digital presence. And it's built on a kind of subscription solution that allows them to create a digital ordering portal for their customers. And it's compatible with most backends and allows restaurants to process their own orders, bypassing kind of food delivery businesses. So that's a company I'm kind of interested in. They've got a couple of nice sides to it. They can, for example, you know, they can kind of link up or create a marketplace for the food delivery businesses to pitch to deliver their food for them, or they can have their own in-house teams, or they can do things like have a hybrid system where they have their own in-house teams for peak hours, and then, you know, fish it out or farm it out to the delivery businesses when it's not that busy. It's young business, but it's got 400 brands operating in the system already, including the likes of Shake Shack, Denny's, Dairy Queen, Wingstop, Five Guys. It processes about 1.8 million orders every day. And at the moment, pretty much like everything at the moment, the valuation is pretty outrageous. But they do have quite an impressive founder CEO, a young guy called Noah Glass, who really does seem to know his stuff. I've listened to a couple of interviews with him now, and he seems to be a really bright guy. And so I'll be keeping an eye closely on it. I won't be investing at 50 times sales, but if it can grow into that valuation, or if there's a good pullback, I'll definitely consider it for my Wall Street.
I won't look at companies these days that are under 50 times sales. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in My Wall Street at the moment. And if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.